Look, that means it. You're retarded. Hey, I saw deaf and dumb cripple today. Are we clear that we don't despise and we don't show any disrespect towards them, whether hidden or expressed? Don't we sometimes even brag, take advantage, or manipulate our fortune? How much of us are we confident to say that we don't ignore them at all from the bottom of our hearts? It's great if you are born with some luck, whether it's health, wealth, intelligence, appearance, or majority. For those who are not, what can one do? It's not their fault after all. When we gain the luck by chance for nothing, feeling triumphant and acting pretentious over a free gift is too much nearsighted. And casting the pitch black cloud by excluding another from a society is too much self-centered, only revealing that we have a long way to reach an authentic society. Indifference, exclusion, an obsession that everybody should be in a certain way has proved how distorted and destructive a world can be. It also eradicated the interwoven beauty of human connections. All tragedies in history have left indelible bloods stemming from the inability and ineptitude of switching our and their situations. The definition of compassion is a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for another who is stricken by misfortune. And some kinds of misfortune could happen anytime and to anybody. From Andrew Solomon's Far From a Tree, a mom who was very shameful about her deaf son gave up raising him. So his grandmother took care of him until he got married to a same deaf girl. One day, he received a phone call from the hospital hearing his mom is in a hospital bed. Later, it turned out that the medicine to cure her serious infection problem destroyed her hearing nerves, and she became deaf too. Actually, I don't have to bring the story from the book. Recently, it also happened to me. The manifestation that their problem comes to my problem. I've been observing and supporting my friend's tough journey to fight with an NS cancer over the 20 months. After she finally overcame it, we had a really good celebration, and she appreciated me a lot for helping her in various ways. However, the blissful news was followed by a dumbfounding one, as my younger sister was diagnosed to have a cancer just about 10 days ago. I'm telling this just to let you know what kind of a sadness I have in my mind. She and I would rely on my friend's experience and knowledge very much, regarding it as a primary source of our hope. We, lucky or unlucky, are the same in sharing common human characteristics. We are all a being of mortality going through life's ordeal and realizing interdependence. Yet, we aspire to be treated with dignity in any misfortune situations. Human sight was created to recognize each person's uniqueness. Human ear to hear one's sadness. Human heart to crumble with one's agony and broaden our sympathy. The affectionate attitude could make the suffering one count on courage and hope to carry on. And it exactly shows the extent of our maturity, just like a self figure reflected on a placid and spotless lake. It's not always others. It's not always those who are marginalized or those who have sickness. It's not always those who have an abnormal and challenging child. In the place of those, I should be replaced in every place, in any time, because we are all related.
Thank you. Deepak and I recently went to Memphis, Tennessee, which is known as the birthplace of soul, the blues, rock and roll, many of those songs that us baby boomers rocked to way back when, in the 50s and 60s. Black music artists got a chance to record their stuff at colorblind music studios. It's also where black music made a crossover into the mainstream via Elvis Presley. He made it acceptable for white radio stations to play this type of music. That says a lot, doesn't it? Most of the 70 years of popular music owes a huge debt to black culture. The spirituals sung in the churches, the blues that were sung in the fields, the rhythms brought from Africa and Haiti. Do you remember Howling Wolf, B.B. King, Aretha Franklin, Isaac Hayes? There are many more. They all came via Memphis. Those artists rose from abject poverty to make a big mark in the world of music, which in part fueled black pride and the civil rights movement shortly thereafter and beyond. Fittingly, Memphis has a relatively new claim to fame, the Museum of Civil Rights, which is extremely well done and a good reason to visit Memphis in itself. It brilliantly tells a full, comprehensive story of the African-American experience in the United States. It is built around the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King was assassinated. Some of the things that stood out for me was learning that there were very courageous men and women who have fought for civil rights from way back, even in the days of slavery. By the time of the American Civil War, there were 4 million slaves in the United States. The entire economy rested on them. The Jim Crow period after the Civil War effectively negated much of the meaning of the Civil War for decades. It was a walk down memory lane for me to see exhibits about all the events of the civil rights movement in the US in the 60s and 70s, the marches, the freedom riders. Frighteningly, the sheer bile and hate directed at the American blacks. It was only 25 years ago there was the massive riots in Los Angeles, and there was a very good art installation about that. What did I learn from my trip to Memphis? What does it have to do with the topic compassion? In a nutshell, I learned that compassion only comes from hearing other people's stories, whether it's through a brilliant museum such as the Museum of Civil Rights, stories gleaned through music history, or just looking around at a city where the history is written in the pattern and look of the neighborhoods, or through just talking to people. We all need to go out of our way to find and listen to the stories of people who are not privileged and really try to get just an inkling of what it's like to walk in their shoes. As for African Americans, the battle goes on. Witness the Black Lives Matter movement and the political backlash the African Americans are finding as they are on their way to full, we hope, on their way to full and rightful place in society, as evidenced by the rise of Trump.
A few weeks ago, I heard Mark Nepo speak, and he said that we write about what we need to learn, not about what we know. The gift of the writers group for me has been that every month we get to delve into the theme of the month and write about what we need to learn. So compassion has been a major focus in my life for quite a while. So for this particular theme, I thought it appropriate to write something autobiographical. So this is my story. And it's called A Compassionate Environmentalist. As I lay down, hidden from view of the house, my back nestled against sun-warmed earth, I was enveloped by the tumble of scents of decay and growth. I breathed deeply and let myself be transported, watching the dappled sunlight through the leaves of the nearby aspens. My eye was caught by the barn swallows swooping and diving. I couldn't help but be entranced by their dance of reverie and survival, a hypnotic, joyous ode to life. As an 8-year-old, exploring the wonders of Ontario's Beaver Valley, nobody had to tell me that I was part of the web of life. I experienced the connection, knew that I belonged to something greater every time that I stepped outside. As I lay back in the tall grass or dug for clay in the stream bank, I lost myself in nature, to nature. Fast forward 15 years. I was among the first graduates in environmental science when that field was in its infancy. Upon graduation, I traveled for the first time to Vancouver Island, a quest to see whales in their native habitat. On the way, the bus twisted and turned through the Alberni Valley, revealing pockets of scarred land, clear cuts that until then I had only read about in books. I felt the agony of the earth ripped open to feed society's ever-growing greed, the need for more and more and more. I ached for the plight of the old growth forests and joined the fight to save Clackwit Sound, Carmana, the Stein Valley. My tool for change wasn't protest, but education. But the fight was the same. There was an enemy to be vanquished, and it took the form of greedy corporations and short-sighted politicians. As the environmental movement evolved, the target shifted to individuals who weren't practicing environmentally friendly habits. How appealing that sense of simple right and wrong was to a young woman looking to create positive change in the world. There's such pleasure in self-righteous indignation, such reassurance in this simplicity of perspective. Another 15 years later, I was back at school, inching my way through a doctorate on eco-philosophy and education. I was interested in developing education programs that go deeper than recycling, look beyond the saving of this particular river, to question the underlying beliefs that enable us to damage our home, ourselves. How, I wondered, do we understand differently what it means to be human? How do we educate to help people connect with that deep experience of self that is aligned with the greater universe? That sense of self that as an 8-year-old, I knew without question. Through my discussions with people who experienced themselves as part of a connected web of being, and those who didn't, what I saw time and time again was sorrow. I saw people disconnected from their souls, some yearning for reconnection, some so removed that they didn't see the loss. As with the clear cuts on Vancouver Island, I felt deeply the pain of those in front of me, the suffering that was caused by lack of connection. Nowhere was this pain more apparent than in people who had happily embraced a consumer lifestyle, the very people who environmentalists viewed with disdain. Their pain emanated from them in an emptiness, a sense of being lost and disconnected, not just from the web of life, but from their own hearts. How could these people be the enemy that I was fighting? Anger and self-righteousness turned to compassion in my heart. Eco-psychologist Theodore Rozak has said that most environmentalists don't trust people to behave as the living planet's children. This comment rang true to me as I saw my friends and colleagues pouring tender hearts and strong convictions into the fight to save ecosystems, but then talking with anger about those people creating environmental harm. I take seriously Gandhi's words that we should be the change that we wish to see in the world. If I'm seeking a world of care and compassion, of kindness and balance, how can I come from a place of anger and finger-pointing? What would it mean to understand the web of life as not only including the barn swallows from my childhood or the giant trees of the West Coast, but also to embrace people, all people, as the living planet's children? What would it mean to acknowledge the sorrow and the struggle of each and every person, the desire to do better, the failed attempts at living out ideals? What would it mean to be a compassionate environmentalist?
Compassion with feeling. The other side of the compassion empathy coin. Several years ago, when a Soul Matters group was reflecting on compassion, it occurred to me that compassion was not always about sorrow, but actually has two forms, relating to sorrow and relating to happiness. Maybe this struck me because while there was little compassion at home during my childhood, it had been a rather joyless atmosphere. She was an accomplished woman with admirable qualities, a talented pianist, organist, choir director, and teacher. She made sure that all her children, including her son, could cook, bake, and mend. She taught her daughters to use a sewing machine with skill. She grew vegetable gardens during the war and later landscaped a larger home with flair. But there was a huge gap. She didn't know how to share another person's joy. For instance, 12-year-old girl coming home after a symphony concert. "Mom, they played Ravel's Bolero. The drummer was a tall blonde lady, and she stood there playing da 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 without stopping for at least 20 minutes. Mother: "Oh, Bolero isn't that long." Daughter: "In her late 20s, has just cleared the last hurdle, the oral defense of her doctoral dissertation. She is sitting in a downtown cocktail lounge with a handsome fellow grad student. She invites her parents to join them to celebrate. Parents arrive. Quick introductions. Mother leans over, perhaps to hug, but instead whispers in daughter's ear, "When's the last time you combed your hair?" Daughter now approaching the deeper end of middle age. She and husband have moved to the Lower Mainland and are prosperous enough to have had their new home landscaped professionally. Mother visits. She and daughter walk around the beautifully designed and beautifully blooming garden. Mother: "Oh, but you don't have any Daphne Odora." Poor daughter. She has learned not to bring balloons of enthusiasm anywhere near mother. They will surely be punctured. But poor mother. She seems to have no empathy for happiness, little capacity to share the pleasures and joys of others. How sadly and deeply deprived she is. Compassion, empathy, is not just for sorrow, unhappy events and outcomes, sad outcomes. Empathy has another side that can feed the spirit, nourish friendship, and make life rich. The capacity to share another's happiness and joy is priceless. Reflect on this and share the joy. Indeed, let it be a dance.
And by wonderful, joyful,